This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Mark, Roshan Kennison and Noel Lim. It is 6 a.m. Thursday, the 30th of July. It feels a little strange that this is the end of the work week, considering today, tomorrow is a Selamat Hari Raya holiday.
Yes, I am looking forward to the 3-day weekend. I'm not sure about you, but I certainly am.
And going anywhere?
Maybe Malacca. It's not Malacca. Ipoh.
Sounds exciting.
Yeah, wrong side of the country, Noel.
Yeah. Going north. It's the last day of the work week.
Yes, I don't think I have any plans this weekend. This is going to be, I'm presuming, I try to avoid public holiday traveling, especially long weekends, because, I mean, I love holidays, but I hate traffic. I hate traffic. So I do not want to get stuck in any 8-hour jams going to anywhere in particular. I mean, otherwise, I would have loved to go to Penang or just drive somewhere, you know. But the pleasure in driving comes from the fact that it's a relatively open road as opposed to, a parking lot.
Yeah, I know, right?
Yeah, I think there is a little bit of concern as well over the travel this weekend. The front page of The Star has a little ticker on the bottom. Be extra careful during this super weekend. So coupled with a picture of crowds of people at what looks like a train station or a bus station. I'm not quite sure.
And on that note, if you are traveling this weekend, just remember to stay safe and keep the SOPs in mind. I think we're seeing cases starting to rise again. So we don't want to go into a situation where the government is forced to do something about it and we enter what was the CMCO or RMCO or whatever version of the MCO comes into play. Because, I mean, I think we all understand how bad that was the last time around, but it is a necessity to flatten the curve if the cases start to rise significantly again.
Absolutely. So be sure to observe all the SOPs possible and stay safe if you are indeed travelling this weekend. But in the meantime, we do have a number of interesting topics to discuss with you today. Noel, what are we going to be looking at?
Something about New Zealand and small states.
Again, I say, I always look forward to the way Noel forward sells.
Very succinct.
Figure out which word she's going to use to forward sell it. 6:30, we're talking about, we're taking a look at international and probably one of the biggest pieces of news today. Is the fact that the tech giants are in Congress right now as we speak, testifying before Congress in their antitrust suit or the antitrust case that's going on. We'll take a look at Hong Kong as well. And President Donald Trump said some things about some things, and we'll be talking about that. I was trying to channel some Noel there, but I think I failed.
Yeah, you're learning well.
Learning from the best. Okay, if you want to weigh in on our conversations, remember you can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Up next, we're going to be looking at maybe some concerns you have over flexible work arrangements. So stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Shakedown Street by The Grateful Dead, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Roshan and Noel. Now, amidst all of the political news that has been coming out of the SLC International trial, out of all the responses to it, I think it's easy to forget that Parliament is still ongoing and that there are still a number of issues being raised during question time. And one of those issues coming out of the Human Resources Ministry is that they are developing a new regulation to streamline work flexibility. So this is considering all the changes that our working environments have undergone since COVID-19 started. An announcement made by the Deputy Minister Awang Solahuddin during question time, saying that the changes would affect the Employment Act and would be in line with international labour standards. So this is an interesting step to take, and admittedly one that the government has kind of flirted with before, because I think they've implemented flexible working arrangements for some of their non-front facing staff, for example, in the public sector, but BFM itself also ran a poll on this yesterday, asking, you know, what are your main concerns with flexible working arrangements? And of the 180 votes it received, 39% voted for salary reductions as their main concern when it comes to these kind of flexi work arrangements.
Yeah, so whenever the Human Resource Ministry, whenever they are thinking about new guidelines, it's always about protecting people, right? It's not really about spurring innovation. So what they want to do is to make sure that people are probably going to be adequately compensated, or there will be a minimum or a floor wage to ensure that people are not being taken advantage of. It should work flexibility be allowed? I think some of the pros and cons are quite obvious. The advantages are, you know, better quality of life. People can do what they need to do at home and also contributes to less traffic jam. Yeah, I mean, that's, I think, the upside of, you know, allowing flexible working arrangements. However, of course, I think employers are quite concerned about productivity.
Yeah, I think it depends on the work as well, right? There are some jobs that allow for flexibility, even in the nature of the work itself. Let's say you're a writer or a journalist or something like that, of that nature, because the hours are also a bit weird. It can, you know, news can break at any time, but that also means that there are times when there are down periods, right? And it's same for most jobs. There are seasonal effects to the way you work. So there are times where you're going to be working till ungodly hours, and there are times where you don't really have that much, as much work as you would normally do. The biggest concern, generally, I think anyone who talks about flexible working arrangements, or even when you think about things like 6-hour work days or 4-day work weeks, is, will this affect my salary if I'm producing the same amount of output? That's always the concern, because the KPI generally is time, right? It's the general concept is that we are selling our time as employees to the company. And unless it's a more progressive company that takes a look at output specifically, irrespective of how much time you spend on the job.
Yeah, for me, this is an interesting result of this poll. I wouldn't have expected salary reductions to be the main answer, because to me, what it says is that it comes down to a lack of trust in employers, perhaps. I guess it says that employers maybe don't trust their employees to be productive on the same level when they're at home. And it says that these employees feel it, you know, and that they're worried that they're not going to be adequately compensated for the time spent working at home. Because I think all of us during this MCO discovered that when you're at home, actually, you know, a lot of the times the work stretches, because you don't have as much, you don't have a clear-cut barrier, you know, a commute to and from work to demarcate when you should stop working. And it can be even more exhausting if you're working at home and you've been forced to work at home, because you also have a multitude of disruptions that you have to navigate. Children who are out of school, elderly parents perhaps who need your assistance, fighting over internet, for example, with a spouse who is also at home. So all of these issues feed into some difficulties that people also experience during the work from home. So I don't really know, you know, for me on a personal level, I think I would have chosen productivity because of the disruptions that I face in my home environment during a work from home week. But at the same time, you know, if we look at this poll, 30% of respondents say no issues, no concerns with flexible working hours, flexible working arrangements, because it's been great. So it's quite a mixed bag of results, I think.
And yes. Yeah. So I think when we talk about, balancing all these various challenges at home, right? So people are now calling it living at work. Yeah. So that's the term that I see being bandied around. And I think that's just this general concern about wage cuts and losing jobs in this period of time. So I think that's why I can imagine why that number is high, especially when you have mortgages, right? You have home mortgage, you have put your kid in a private school or international school. The moment they stop in a private school, they can't go back to the public school. It's very difficult to make that transition.
It's a very difficult transition.
Yeah, so they have to hold down a job. They must have a minimum income to sustain that lifestyle.
I think that's always the biggest concern. Whenever your expenses, lifestyle creep is one thing, but also the commitments you have. And that's why you want to maintain, you get not stuck. I don't want to use that that kind of feeling, but in the end, that's why you stay in the 9-to-5, the so-called rat race, because you have bills to pay overall. And there is a certain segment that has higher bills to pay because that's not to say that their problems are bigger than the lowest socioeconomic bracket as well, because it's just different types of problems. But specifically here, I think salary reduction is always going to be the first concern, right? Because it's the how do we value work? Mm-hmm. Is it time spent, or is it hours in the office? Is it pure output? And in that case, what is your output as an employee in a particular company? Because that can range. It's very difficult to tell. Like if your administrative staff, what's your output?
Yeah, that's the thing. And I think to a large extent, Asian cultures and Asian working practices also still do value, still do place a lot of value on your physical presence sitting at your desk in the office, right? It doesn't matter if you're playing Tetris on your computer, so long as you're sitting there and
looking. So long as they don't know you're playing Tetris.
Exactly. So long as you're sitting there and looking busy, right? So I guess, you know, perhaps this is a step in the right direction that the government is looking at introducing legislation and regulations for this. But do let us know what you think. What are your main concerns when it comes to flexible work arrangements? You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We have some messages coming up for you, and then we're going to be taking a look at country strategies and whether small countries banding together really actually works. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Next Year by the Foo Fighters, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Roshan and Noel. 6:21 a.m. Thursday the 30th of July, and now this morning we're taking a look at an article in The Conversation. So the titled here, When Great Powers Fail, New Zealand and Other Small States Must Organise to Protect Their Interests. So New Zealand, I mean, we've seen Jacinda Ardern at the forefront of a lot of positive news flow, or even amidst this COVID-19 pandemic. But the thing about New Zealand is that they've always been very, very much bought into the idea of an international system of laws and regulations. But with the COVID-19 pandemic, this article argues that really, I mean, the UN Security Council has not been able to do much. The WHO has been weakened by the withdrawal of America. So these large groupings of international consortiums, basically, are losing power. So what then is the recourse for smaller states like New Zealand and even here in Malaysia? Should they band together to present a stronger front and perhaps have the opportunity to redefine the international stage?
Yes, I think no country is immune to the fact there is slowing economic growth rates right now. I mean, also this year has been really unusual. But developed countries, and that would include New Zealand, even though small, you know, when you have slower economic growth, you will have slower, a lower rate of job creation. And because of that, then you have a group of locals that you know, unemployment may be on the rise, right? So that's going to be an issue. And because of that, then you may want to limit immigration. And coupled with this problem is also automation. As more automation comes in, there will even be less jobs available, or different kind of jobs or different skill sets, and people need to just upskill more quickly. So because of this thing where you have to limit immigration, it also raises this thing about nationalism. And then when you become more nationalistic, you become more protective of your borders, right? Even if it's irrational.
Yeah, I guess. Sorry about that. It is interesting, right? Because we've seen in this, as globalization prospered in the last 20, 30, 40 years, and technology grew, we also saw pockets of society that were, well, lost their jobs, right? For lack of a better term, big pockets of the Rust Belt in the US, large swaths of them lost their jobs to India, China, to the rest of Asia that was pivoted over. And while Asia prospered with that and the middle class grew, they were left ignored in the States, for example. And lo and behold, 20 years later, 10 years later, it came back to bite the US in terms of populism, in terms of a growing Make America Great Again rhetoric, right? And this story in particular that we're looking at here is interesting because New Zealand's first party has hired what the people known as the bad boys of Brexit, which are basically PR people for populist right-wing camps, and they helped Brexit, and now New Zealand First is hiring them to help with their own PR strategy. Is this, I don't know, does this signal something a bit more interesting ahead for New Zealand's future? I don't know. But essentially, it's the larger situation of where when you have big powers like Russia and the US not really following the rules-based system that has been employed since World War II or thereabouts, it starts to make it's the little countries, the smaller ones, Malaysia notwithstanding, that will get lost in there, right? Because then you got to start picking sides, as it is in the US-China Cold War. We've talked about how does Malaysia need to choose a side in this situation?
Yeah. I mean, years ago, there was this theory of how states react to larger powers. And it was, the choice was either you balance against them or you band together. So bandwagoning or balancing. Those are the typical two responses to, say, for example, here in Southeast Asia, it would be the presence of China, right? A local superpower that essentially dominates our trade relations. So we have supranational bodies have been in existence for many, many years, right? Since the end of World War One and the League of Nations first appeared, but are they still relevant? And with the almost waning of larger supranational bodies like the UN, can smaller ones like ASEAN potentially rise to fill the gap? I guess that is a question that we are going to be seeing crop up more as we try and figure out what COVID-19 will mean in the longer term. But do let us know what you think. You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We have the 6:30 news bulletin coming up next, but first, Valerie by Amy Winehouse, BFM 89.9. The Morning Run with Lin Mark, Roshan Kanasin and Noel Lim. 6:40 a.m. Thursday, the 30th of July, and we're taking a look at some international stories here, particularly over in the US. Something unprecedented is happening almost as we speak, because four of the biggest names in tech are going to be giving evidence to the US Congress. So this is Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, Sundar Pichai of Google, Tim Cook of Apple, and Jeff Bezos of Amazon. Will all have to give evidence. Jeff Bezos, particularly, who is the world's richest man, he's never testified before either house, much less all of them being called together.
Yeah, Jeff, like we're first name basis.
Your
friends,
pal,
right?
Jeff.
My pal Jeff. Yeah, he's been avoiding it, right? And just distancing himself from having to be in front of Congress. But Sundar Pichai has, Tim Cook has. So, and they're also a bit more, I guess, a bit more careful about it overall. But this has been interesting because, you know, Mark Zuckerberg in his previous stint at Congress was criticized as being a cyborg, right? That he was very robotic in his delivery. In this one, so far, I mean, it's still going on. But one of the things that stuck out is the fact that he basically went after the other tech giants. He's trying to basically say, why are you coming after me? Look at this fella. Look at that fella. This fella also is so big. So he's like going, he went off what Bloomberg is describing as off script a bit. So he said, he looked at, you know, we're not the biggest messaging service in the US. iMessage is, which is an Apple product. We're not the biggest ad service in the country. Google is. We're not the fastest growing ad service. Amazon is. So they're just trying to just throw mud in the air and just kind of make it a bit, throw sand in the air, sorry, to make it a bit cloudy. So it's very interesting to see how he's going. Because before that, he was more of a very stoic in his answers. So it's very interesting to see this change of strategy.
Yeah, so perhaps your strategy, if you cannot beat them, you confuse them, confuse politicians. Yeah, so that could very well be their strategy. I mean, I can only imagine all four of them would have sat down at a dinner table and really discussed quite extensively how they were going to approach this. And I'm sure they were properly briefed by their lawyers and so forth. And so I think one of their mantra could be break us up, over-regulate us, and you give Chinese tech companies more power. That could be one of
their... Oh, that's a very powerful
persuasive
strategy.
Could be quite a persuasive narrative for them.
It could be, especially since I think even if you look at the comments that are coming out of all of the candidates in the November presidential election, you know, everyone is hawkish on China to a certain degree.
Mm. And so, you know, in the past, we used to talk about companies having monopolies and why it is problematic because they control pricing. Mm. But now in the case of technology companies, they control your data, right? From WhatsApp, Facebook, Instagram. They know everything about you, what you do, what time you woke up, what time you started looking at your emails, what you write in the emails. So that's Google. So, so I can imagine why, regulators will be quite concerned. And, you know, this is not just going to happen in the US. Europe will look to what the US is doing and they will likewise follow.
Yeah, I think the Europe, in terms of antitrust, is more strict than the US. They've been more proactive. They've fined Google and Facebook in the past before. Google, I'm pretty sure, has been fined. I'm not sure about Facebook. But it is interesting to see that I've never heard of a public listed company bragging that it was behind its competitors. And that's literally what Facebook, Zuckerberg said, right? He said, in many areas, we are behind our competitors. And basically, it's this whole narrative that Facebook is too big, it has too much data. And clouding the situation is helpful. It confused them, right? You know, that's what you said. Because now he's pointing to, you know, he said YouTube is the biggest video platform. We're not that. The fastest growing app is TikTok. So again, just fragment the idea that Facebook is the behemoth that Congress thinks it is. The point of the matter, though, is Facebook has a lot of information from a lot of people. It may not be the biggest video platform, the ad platform, but it's still a very, very big social network with very powerful influence.
Yeah, so this is the concern is that all of these companies are getting almost too big to fail, right? And I think this narrative has become even stronger during COVID-19. And some of the general criticisms are also that I think of to do with the copy, acquire, kill strategies. All four of them are accused of doing so: copy others' ideas, buy a company that threatens you, and then even potentially just kill it off to ensure that you don't have competition. Because that's the heart of the matter. You know, you have to have competition in order to have a healthy business environment.
Yeah. So that comes down to ethics. One tech company that has a lot of experience dealing with governments, that would be Microsoft, and they have also come under scrutiny in the 90s, I think the late 90s. And so as a result, they also changed their business model. So regulations can have an impact, and they started to play a lesser role in consumer internet, and instead they moved to cloud computing, right?
And one more thing they did was they resuscitated Apple. Right, they gave Apple a loan at that point, $400 million, to keep them alive in an era where Apple was on its deathbed at that point.
Yeah, so it can influence a business, and that means new incumbents or new players can come in. Yeah.
Microsoft intentionally kept its competition alive in the early 2000s when Steve Jobs at that point had just rejoined Apple. So Microsoft is probably the most experience in terms of dealing with the government at this point.
Very interesting things, though, coming out of the US. So we're going to be keeping an eye on it, but nevertheless, let us know what you think. WhatsApp us 01878988999 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We've got some messages coming up, and then we're taking a look at the front pages of our local newspapers. So stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. That was It's Still Rock and Roll to Me by Billy Joel, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn, Roshan and Noel. We're taking a look at the newspapers this morning because I have the Star in front of me, and honestly, looking at it, it feels a little bit anticlimactic considering the barrage of political news that's come out over the past 2 days or so surrounding the SRC International trial. But nevertheless, the Star's front page here has Prime Minister Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin talking about the loan moratorium, which has been extended here. So that's their big single word headline, extended on the front page of the Star.
Same in NST as well, targeted assistance for individuals. So if you had lost your jobs or you had suffered a pay cut, there will be some flexibility in returning, in paying back your loans. Likewise, SMEs also, there will be some targeted assistance, but I think the conditions were not so specified. And so I suppose it might be left to negotiations between the company, the borrower and the bank.
Yeah, I've got the Malaysian Reserve, which the headline is a bit different. It goes with housing loan applications dive 72% in April as virus takes hold. I don't think that's surprising. I think during that time, not many people were looking at taking any type of loan or big ticket items during that period. But the other stories in the paper are actually quite interesting. There was one, because right now we're back in Parliament, one of the MPs asked the Health Minister, Dr. Adam Baba, about the cost of treating critically ill COVID-19 patients. And apparently it costs 18,270 ringgit for 21 days on average. And that's in the government hospital. That's how much it costs them to maintain and to treat them. And this is the median cost of 870 ringgit per day of an average admission period of 21 days. And there are five stages to a COVID-19 patient. One is stage one is symptom. Stage two is symptoms without pneumonia. Stage three is symptoms with pneumonia. Stage four is pneumonia and requires assistance with oxygen. And stage five is multi-organ dysfunction, critical patients. So these stage four and stage five are in the ICU at this point. I didn't know that. I'm glad to know that, to learn a bit about that. But basically, it's this is the cost that the government faces. And right next to this story, again, Parliament's ongoing, the government has decided to cancel the proposed petrol subsidy program introduced by the previous administration. One of the reasonings here is that it caused retail price gaps between Peninsula and Borneo states. So I guess that's done, dusted. It's gone.
Yeah, I think when you talk about the five stages of COVID patients, that is quite chilling if you think about it. And even more so considering we're heading into a long weekend and there is the prospect of a lot of people travelling across the state borders. The Star's second page is basically talking about travel advisories, calling for strict adherence to SOPs. And I think it can't be, it always needs to be re-emphasised, right? Adhere to SOPs, physical distance as much as possible, help flatten the curve.
Yes, at the moment when you let people travel from town to town, it does increase the risk of spreading the virus. And so the Ministry of Health is considering emulating the Australian rule on wearing face masks everywhere the moment you step out of your home. So that is something they are considering. May not be such a bad idea. I mean, after all, you already have to wear it in many office buildings. Mm-hmm. Also, PKR demands 10 million ringgit each from 20 defectors, and this will include Datuk Sri Azmin Ali, Zuraida Kamarudin, and as well as Datuk Saifuddin Abdullah.
Interesting stuff there. I've actually got, while we're talking about COVID-19, I'm taking a look at the Reserve's editorial and opinion page, and the Malaysian Reserve's assistant news editor has a piece here. We don't need a boss coup cluster. And I think these are the fears that's come around from the 1,000-person gathering in front of the court on Monday, or Tuesday? This week has seemed to blend it together.
Yeah, Tuesday. Blend together.
Tuesday. And you know, I think he starts it off with putting into context, right, how we made fun of other countries for protesting and, I mean, basically having large groups of people together. And now we've done the same thing in our own backyard. 1,000 people is not an insignificant number of people together in one location at the same time. And also considering the fact that this includes politicians and MPs as well, I really hope in 2 weeks we don't see numbers jump up the triple digits, because that's the line, right? The DG has said, if we go in the triple digits, we will see conditions be reinstated, and any progress we've made over the last few months to reboost the economy will not be not for naught, but will be severely hampered.
And I also have the Malay Mail open in front of me, and their lead story here is Shafi is still chief minister. He has the majority, insists Sabah's deputy chief minister. So this is the political showdown that's happening over in Sabah. I think there is a press conference scheduled for 10 o'clock today to see who in fact does have the majority, because Tan Sri Musa Aman has said that he's accumulated enough statutory declarations to go to the governor and to take control.
And scheduled in about an hour, actually, we'll be talking to Dr. Hamidin Abdul Hamid, research fellow at Ilham Center, about this and his thoughts on the matter. He seems to be following the politics of Sabah quite closely. So stay tuned for his insights.
And in the meantime, we are heading into the 7 o'clock news bulletin now, and then more business news and analysis. So be sure to stay tuned. But first, here is Queen with Princes of the Universe, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.